data on the bottom, and then your transactions, your processes, and then you get to your bigger capabilities. They all build on top of each other. So even if a founder says, I've got fantastic data, but you've gone through and you've completely destroyed your processes because you're special, right? And we do things differently. Then again, that problem begins to percolate up. You can no longer do the reporting the way you want to. You can no longer take advantage of the new technologies, whether it be supplier networks, AI, and whatnot.
Growing a business requires a holistic approach that extends beyond sales and marketing. This approach needs alignment among people, processes, and technologies. So if you're a business owner, operations, or finance leader looking to learn growth strategies from your peers and competitors, you're tuned into the right podcast. Welcome to the WBS Podcast, where scalable growth using business systems is our number one priority. Now, here is your host, Sam Gupta.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the WBS Podcast. I'm Sam Gupta, your host and principal consultant at the independent ERP and digital transformation consulting firm Elevate IQ. Understanding why ERP implementation are more challenging today requires going back to fundamentals. The traditional business models described by frameworks such as Porter's value chain assumed one direction flow of information. But as customers' expectations change, the newer architecture requires bi-directional flow of information to get the immersive and seamless omnichannel experience. Also, just because ERP demos might make the advanced capabilities such as ATP appear easy, they are not easy to set up and require a transformational mindset along with changes in data and processes. Otherwise, the issues are likely to percolate up in ways you would not expect. In today's episode, our guest, Matt Ellis, discusses why implementing mature ERP capabilities requires organizational readiness. He also discusses the evolution of systems and data and why advanced customer experience patterns require bidirectional flow of information. Finally, he discusses several stories, including the barriers for change and their mitigation plans. Let me introduce Matt to you. Matt Ellis is the Senior Manager of CIO Advisory of Bearing Point, a multinational management and technology consulting firm with European roots and global reach. Matt has amassed over 9 years of experience in consulting, focusing on strategic technology consulting. In his current role, he focuses on CIO advisory work with an emphasis on ERP strategy, operating models, and digitization. He also serves as part of the leadership team for technology strategy. Matt earned his BS in Management, Finance, and Analytical Consulting from Purdue University. He also earned his MBA in Finance, Economics, and Strategic Management from the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. With that, let's get to the conversation. Hey, Matt, welcome to the show.
Wow, thank you. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited as well. Anytime, whenever I have anybody from the ERP community, it's always a pleasure because the stories are always fascinating, at least personally for me.
Yeah, well, likewise, it's always always fun to get to go down a rabbit hole on an ERP discussion. I can't have those conversations with my normal friends.
Exactly. Only ERP people are probably going to appreciate, but sometimes it's also educational for our audience. They appreciate that as well. So just to kick things off, do you want to start with your quick background as well as what you're focusing on these days?
Yeah, sure. So I'm one of our leaders here in the US for a company called Bearing Point. And what we focus on is really helping companies establish a digital backbone. It falls underneath the umbrella of digitalization. But when we dig into it, we really look at using ERP or just the digital landscape ecosystem to help accelerate a company forward from where they are today. So a lot of my clients are just kicking off early stages of evaluating where they should go. Most of them are still on pretty old systems, and they're looking for help navigating the selection process, the SI selection process, and then just the overall program management of an ERP project that's so large and comprehensive.
Okay, very interesting. So obviously, I want to peel some layers there in terms of how you define these things. And in the ERP community, one of the challenges that we all have is the language, I guess. You know, whatever you are going to say, that could mean a lot of different things for other people.
Absolutely.
So we have one of the standard questions that we ask every single guest, you know, before we get into these topics that we just discussed, right? So that is going to be your perspective on business growth.
So I think the revenue growth one is probably a not very interesting question. I think the question around business growth in the context of capabilities is probably a lot more exciting, and just kind of the transition of where people are investing their dollars, the ROI that they're getting out of those. And so if we kind of look at, you know, back in the day, it was a lot of how do we make processes more efficient and or more effective to make sure you can deliver a process, execute it, and you're just throwing bodies at it. There's a little bit of technology that came through it. Basic ERP really helped facilitate that. And so I really feel like right now where a lot of the capability growth and opportunities for companies going forward is how to analyze that information. They have so much data at their disposal. How can they process that and gain better insight about their customers, about their suppliers, and really start to look at the way that they conduct their business internally with using their processes? So how can they make those more effective and more efficient?
I could not agree more. Great perspective. Absolutely love it. So now let's go back to some of the sort of keywords that you had mentioned, and I want to hit on those. So let's say you mentioned digital backbone, I guess, and I would love to understand what is a digital backbone for you when you, let's say, get into any engagement, if you are going to have any sort of stories that you can provide the frame of reference. Okay, you know, maybe they had backbone, maybe they did not. And what was the roadmap for designing that backbone?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think that's really, it's, I use it almost synonymously with digitalization.
Okay.
But which is another buzzword, which warrants a definition behind it. So when I think of old school Porter's value chain, you start with your suppliers, got your inbound logistics, you do your manufacturing, and then your delivery and to your customer, and then you've got your overall supporting finance and HR, IT.
Yeah,
it was very much a one direction flow of information. Right, you can never get the data to go flow back upstream.
Yeah.
So, and there was lots of reasons behind that. A lot of times they're being done in different systems, right? Yeah. There's kind of, they're all disparate systems and they weren't interconnected. And so, we started using the word digital backbone, where it provides the overall, call it spine for the business, where data and information can flow back and forth, right? It's not just the brain telling your hands and legs to move, but you're also getting signals coming backwards as well. So there's a lot of really good examples where now if you put that backbone in place, you can get real-time information from point of sales at retail that automatically feeds your integrated business planning modules to start ramping up production in certain areas, or maybe there's a regional trend that starts to take shape that you can act on almost in real time. It's not a post-mortem analysis, you know, 6 months or a year later when the season's already ended. So one of the companies that's done a really good job of this, and unfortunately I can't take credit because it's not my client, but it's Zara, the retail fashion group. Their point of sales is heavily interlinked with their design teams and their manufacturing groups.
Okay. So very interesting comment there. So I definitely want to dig a little bit more into that. So I can relate with the example when you mentioned, you know, one directional flow of information and just getting the information from upstream to your downstream channels or systems, I guess. I don't know how you define that as well, I guess. So maybe dig a little deeper into that And I don't know, Misi, this is always Zara, the example that you mentioned, obviously, they are really big. they can do a lot of things. I don't know if that is going to be applicable to SMB companies, because always these things are going to be expensive, right? There are going to be other layers in terms of the data versus the operational sort of, transactional systems. I think wires get crossed there as well in terms of what we are doing with this data. Are we utilizing this feed only for planning purposes and then finally feeding into ERP? So sometimes, there could be crossovers there as well. So I don't know if you're going to have any sort of counter there.
So I think that type of information is applicable at all the different levels. And so a really easy one is availability to promise.
Yeah.
What is the data and information saying at the manufacturing level? How quickly can you produce it? And that's in helping inform the customers on what they're able to purchase. So it's, it is the Amazon experience, right? It's going to be delivered in 2 to 3 days.
Yeah.
But that is a capability now that, while it may have started off on within some of the ultra large enterprises, it's very standard now within any business, all the way down to the, $300-400 million mom and pop companies.
Okay. So very interesting. So the example that you mentioned, and again, I'm sort of peeling some layers there, I guess, because we need to understand this better. So in this particular case, you mentioned that, Zara is doing POS plus, they have to have that whole design and merchandising, workflow integrated as part of your POS. Otherwise, they'll not be able to run their business, which makes sense, I guess, for most retailers, especially if you're looking for your apparel brand, the way they like to think about their ERP. Traditionally speaking, if you look at, in the mid-market, they were never into the ERP game. For them, ERP was always that POS layer, merchandising, planning, the planning system. They were never into sort of ERP, because for them, it didn't make sense. The maximum that they're going to have is probably POS plus WMS plus TMS plus the whole SNOP. And that's how most of the supply chain suites are designed as well. Okay, but they don't get into that real financial integration, the real accounting integration. The ERP was always sort of the stepchild. So in this particular industry, whatever you are telling makes sense. But are you seeing similar trend in the other industries as well?
So I think we focus primarily in manufacturing. Okay. So that's very much holds true there. We have a large presence in retail, industrial, automotive. Those are all areas that are absolutely showing a lot of those same capabilities. Some of them may not go directly to a end retail customer, but ultimately there's always a customer that's asking for information and availability.
Yeah, definitely. So do you want to define, let's say if people are not familiar with, what ATP is, and there are going to be some listeners who just don't know what ATP is. So number one, define ATP. Number two, ATP is going to be, everybody's going to claim, hey, we got ATP, you can do it. Your ERP guys are going to claim that, they have ATP. Your supply chain suite people are going to claim that, we have ATP as well. I don't know if order management systems, they claim that, but everybody's claiming they have ATP. So how do you sort of bring everything together and do the real ATP, I guess?
You're right. When I go in and I help clients put together a selection project, we'd always put a little bit of art of the future, art of the possibility out there. And what are some of the capabilities you want to deliver? ATP always comes up, which it's a very, very mature capability. Yeah. Yes, every system has the ability to do it if the underlying data and procedures and policies are in place. For your listeners, the background on ATP is the ability for a customer or an inside salesperson to be able to look at a screen and say, that widget that you're ordering, we have it in stock. Here's what we've got for logistics, for delivery, UPS versus US mail versus whatever. And this is when we can get it to you. If it's not in stock, it has the ability to look at what the backlog of manufacturing is to see if the raw material's in stock to be able to build it. And if it's not, then it will look at what the incoming raw material looks like and be able to forecast it out. So that you may have lead time on raw material that's 3 to 4 months, and it will all take that into account. The it's that Amazon experience of when is something going to get delivered. So now, if you kind of, I kind of listed off some of the pieces in there. Think of the amount of data that has to go in to support that calculation. It's the, you know, is your inventory correct?
Yep.
Is your manufacturing timelines correct? Is your routing, your standard times to manufacture things correct?
Yeah.
Are you tied into your logistics systems to be able to make sure that you have good visibility into the most effective and efficient way to get something to deliver to a customer?
Yeah.
It gets even more complex if you are a multinational or have multiple distribution centers, because then it can start doing analysis to say, hey, which distribution center should we send this out of? Which manufacturing facility should we make it out of? Which all could have pretty significant impacts. Again, lots and lots of data that goes into it. If you don't have the data, then it breaks right away. But then the second layer to that is also around policies.
Yeah.
And so, and as an example, if things are just coming in and flowing through your order system in a straight line, in a linear way, then that's absolutely great. The thing is there's a lot of times when, especially when you start having big customers, where inside sales, well, you know what, that customer over there is a high priority. I really need to make him happy.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to reshuffle the priority of orders, and I'm going to move his order up to the front of the queue.
Yeah.
That right there will drastically impact and break your ATP processes. So again, having the underlying data in the policies processes in place to secure ATP is paramount, because at the end of the day, the technology, you're right, every single technology stack claims they can do ATP. Maybe some better than others.
Yeah.
However, it's really pushing the work back to the client, not to the technology provider.
Yeah. So very interesting commentary there. I can probably have 5 or 7 branches there in that conversation. Okay. So this is going to get really interesting. So number one comment, I definitely want you to touch on the high priority stuff, right? So in my mind, if I look at ATP, high priority should be accounted as part of the ATP algorithm. And that's how probably my customers are going to feel that, you know what, if you're doing the LATP, account for everything that I care for, because I want this magical ATP. So why is it breaking?
Well, so it changes because not everything comes in order, right?
Yeah.
And so as an example, one of my last clients, they're a $2 billion manufacturer of electronic home goods.
Yeah.
Right? So it's basically building materials, right?
Yeah.
So they've got some of their large retailers that they work with are the Home Depots and Lowe's. That's absolutely great. But then they also work through smaller distributors, and they go directly to builders and contractors, and they even have a business that goes direct to consumer. And so while me as an individual might reach out, place an order for 5 of their units,
yeah,
that's a pretty low priority order, even though I might be promised a specific date.
Yeah.
The fact that Home Depot can come in tomorrow and say, you know what, we need 1,000 of them delivered next week.
Yep.
My order now falls really low on the priority list, and it
yep.
breaks ATP calculation. So it's not necessarily about, say, if orders are coming in a linear fashion,
yeah,
absolutely, it's easy. But when they're coming in with different needs and different priorities,
yeah.
When Home Depot counts for 20% of your overall revenue,
yeah,
are you not going to prioritize? All right, it makes things more difficult.
Yeah, so let's dig a little bit more into that. And I don't know if this is going to be a limitation of some systems that you have experienced, I guess, you know, and some people are going to feel that, you know what, that should be part of ATP. You know, why is algorithm not really accounting for that? It could be because you have multiple systems in the architecture, so there could be so many different layers that could drive these things. But one of the points that I really want to touch on is, I don't know how many people are going to understand the ATP versus allocation, right? So ATP allocation, they sort of go hand in hand in general, right? So if you have priority accounted in your system, if you are keeping the priority, I guess, at the customer level, then you should be able to allocate, according to the priority. You are absolutely right that, you know, if you are going to get an order and that is going to change your priorities, then you sort of go back and change the ATP algorithm. So obviously ATP is going to be all over the place, but what people are going to be thinking that the system should be able to account automatically, I guess. So touch a little bit more. Why is that such a big deal?
No, I think you just hit on it. You alluded to one of the policies that can be put in place to make it work.
Yeah.
And that is, hey, we have an allocation of X number of units for high priority, Y number of units for medium priority, and Z for low. And then if I order something that's in a medium priority, then that should stay consistent. But if you don't do that allocation at that high level, then things break. But again, that's one of the policies and processes. A lot of my clients have not thought through that. Well, they're currently not doing that. They haven't thought through it, and really they don't get to that stage until later on when they're actually doing the implementation and they're working with an SI talking about the pros and cons of specific implementation designs. So there could definitely be downfalls to that. And do you not allocate enough at that high priority where you lose business with Home Depot because you're not able to meet their demands?
Yeah, so let's touch a little bit more on that allocate enough, I guess. And sometimes, I mean, businesses can be all over the place, especially if a business is going to be as large as a $2 billion or $300 million. I mean, that's a sizable business in my mind. You are going to have a lot of departments, a lot of people. They are going to have their own philosophy in terms of how they want to use their system, I guess. And that actually screws up everything, right? Because inventory has to be centralized. Allocation has to be centralized. ATP, if you want it to work, it has to be centralized. And if people have their own sort of beliefs, philosophies, culture, whatever, you know, they might have, it throws off the entire equation, I guess. Go ahead if you have any follow-up comments there. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. But that's where they're going in the future. And there's that change management aspect associated with it. But the part that's missing out of that equation is where they're coming from today. Because very, very, very few of my clients are coming from a spot where they have that level of discipline. If we keep talking about ATP and we're talking about, you know, sales accounts, account execs who have the ability to place orders and they're responsible, ultimately responsible for Home Depot being satisfied, I guarantee you they are going to do everything they can and they will find a way in the system to change the priority and the allocations, right? Because their compensation depends on it. So if you look at it, that's where they're coming today and where they need to be tomorrow, I agree, centralized with a strong level of expectation and controls around it. Then it's, yes, it's just change that you have to manage going forward. And I think that's probably one of the areas that clients falter the most is that they don't look at that, those types of changes. Most of them are focused on, you know, what button am I going to click instead of the one I used to, right? Yeah. It's very tactical. But looking at the meta processes and the changes in mindset and philosophy associated with ERP, that's much more important.
Yeah, so very interesting. So let's talk about change management a little bit, I guess, you know, and that itself. And I'm going to have a little fun with you because typically I'm in your seat, right? So, and that is always a struggle, right, with change management, because even if the customers, and we go through this exercise on a daily basis, the customers who are going to feel, hey, you know what, we are open, we can change anything, we will be super open-minded, okay, you tell us what you want us to change, and as soon as you talk about the specific topic that need to be changed, they are like, no, this is not happening, because my workflow is going to be impacted because of that, or my workflow is going to be harder than what I am used to, and it's very, very, very hard to see through things, right? Because when you talk about inventory has a lot of layers, and all of those layers need to be analyzed for inventory and ATP to work. And as you correctly pointed out, that this is a very mature process. Everything has to be in line for it to work. If you break one chain, the whole chain breaks. So I don't know, how do you deal with it?
There's lots of it. So I think the first step is to realize how much, you know, be able to somewhat quantify or understand, relate to users who are going through this change. Yeah. You and I are in IT. I like to say I'm not in IT, that I'm more business and I just understand IT. But like we're close to the problem on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Right? But if we look at recent clients of mine, they're coming from systems that were implemented 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you got to think through the concept of Moore's law, right? The number of, from Intel, the number of transistors on a chip doubles every 2 years. And so that's a radical amount of change, because every time the number of transistors change, capabilities change from a data processing, and you know, sometimes it's just graphics, so it doesn't matter too much. But the technology capabilities in general are drastically changing. And our users have to wrap their mind around that, because most humans are not used to exponential change.
Yeah.
But I think that's the first bit, is understanding where they're coming from and being able to relate to the fact that some of the stuff that we're putting in front of them, S/4HANA, the capabilities that are out there are almost, you know, I'm going to be a little exaggerated a little bit, but like they're life changing, because a lot of them are coming from that green screen, JD Edwards, where I had a client that had gone through and repurposed the fax number field to capture email addresses. Okay,
so that would be fun.
All right, so when all of a sudden, like now you've got mobile capabilities and you can run a lot of your work orders from your production work orders and do IDP from your phone, it's obviously a huge change. So understanding where they're coming from is the first part. But then the second part that we really stress is making them comfortable with the decision, making them involved. So the very first thing I notice when clients call me for our very first phone calls, who's on the call? And it is amazing. It's always the VP of IT or the CIO, director of applications, right? It's never the business.
Yeah.
Why is the VP of IT or CIO calling me about the ERP? There is no module in ERP called IT.
Yep.
Right. So these are business projects. And so the way at least we approach it is, when we help do selections, we largely don't talk to the IT team. And like it's all about the business. What do they need? What are their pain points? What's going to make a difference for them? And really starting to establish ownership of the decision and establish champions kind of within the ranks early on, so that they're excited about the change and they have control on where they're going with it.
Yeah. So some very interesting points there. So we'll touch on those as well. So let's talk about, you know, obviously business versus IT, and that's always going to be a classic debate. Okay. And sometimes you are going to wish for that. Okay. Right now I have IT, maybe I should have business. But then you are talking to business and they don't really understand the sort of the data modeling concept. They really struggle with it, and they cannot see things because just they probably don't have any implementation experience. So it's very hard for them, right? So you probably need both, I guess, you know, somebody who has experience with the data modeling in terms of how relational data needs to be structured. The other point that you mentioned, moving from green screen to any ERP, I guess, you know, even if it is going to be very small ERP, I mean, that's a massive, massive lift. Okay, the example that you had mentioned, I mean, that's a very easy example, okay, where you are modeling your email addresses inside your fax field. Okay, the maximum impact that you are going to have is going to be at the field level. But in our case, when we get into the engagements, we see really fun scenarios, okay? We are going to ask, okay, what are some guidelines in terms of your customer master, okay? The ship to could be all over the place. You know, there is no parent account. Sometimes they have parent account, sometimes they don't. So, you know, it could be all over the place. The items are all over the place. There is no sort of scheme for item numbers. There's no scheme for the bombs, design, and ERP around that. And these guys are going to feel that, you know what, this is all my business. I'm not changing anything because that is going to impact my legacy transactions. So give me some trade secrets here, man. How do you overcome this, I guess?
Yeah, you're right. Everyone always has data issues, right? It's always interesting, because what I start to share with them is it's almost like a data model or a transaction, you know, the different transaction layers that occur. So, you know, at the base of anything is your data. Then you've got your transactions, and then you've got your organization and shifting of data to inform you around like what a P&L might look like, some of the reporting layers. And then you have some of those bigger capabilities out there around, like, you know, AI and big data that's a lot of the companies are focused on. And so when I go in, I the very first thing that I look at is that bottom layer of data. And you're absolutely right. Everyone has always done something weird in there. All right. So whether it be lack of parent-child relationships, my client right now, their item master is completely flat. It has no attributes, and so just the number of part numbers or item numbers is through the roof. When they could probably rationalize that to a certain extent, and I show them that it's, you know, if you don't structure your data correctly, then those issues start to percolate up through the different layers. All of a sudden, now you can't do the transaction correctly.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's too complex, which then means when you try to run some sort of optimization around ATP, you can't do ATP if your item master is flat and you don't, you can't do those things. It percolates up. And so we start to communicate that a lot of people's pain points, the things that they're complaining about today, which almost always revolve around reporting. It takes too long to do a manual report because they're trying to manually match up all these mismatched data layers down below coming from different systems and poor data structures. Then again, the root cause is the data. So you're absolutely right. It's a story and it's a narrative that it's a little repetitive.
Yeah.
The thing is it's always really enlightening for clients because it hasn't clicked to them. They think it's something to do with the technology. Well, why can't the technology just connect this for me? And it's like, well, no, it can if you structure the data correctly. So you're right. Data is always a major issue for our clients, especially when they're coming from the older systems.
So what if they are not just willing to change? I mean, you are telling them this is not the best thing to do, you know, it's not smart, and they are telling you that, you know what, no, I'm not doing it, I'm not changing, I want ERP to fix everything. So what will you do?
So it's...
I'm having fun here because this is my spot.
It's a lot of client relationship management, right? When we come in, the way we approach it, it's not a, hey, we're a tech experts and we're going to tell you what to do, right? It's we come in and we get really close with the clients. We try to understand their issues. And so a lot of times, and I can't say that there is a silver bullet of, hey, look at this data and it's going to change your mind, right? Yeah. But at the same time, it's just kind of walking them through the process. You know, and what's, hey, well, if you're a controller, what's meaningful for your business, right? I need to reduce manual transactions. Okay, well, how are you going to reduce manual transactions?
Yeah.
The fact that you're manually posting, you know, copying and pasting transactions from your bank account into your ledger and trying to match the cash transactions, that's painful. Let's talk about what you need to do that, right? And honestly, I feel like if we look at the people who generally are receptive of that message,
yeah,
and the ones who are resistant, it almost always differs by where they are in the organization. If you're a management team, I found that most of the time they're pretty receptive of it. The people who are a little more resistant are definitely the ones who are doing the transaction today, because it's, you know, job security, they're afraid of what tomorrow looks like. There's a certain amount of change that comes along. And so with the management team, it's always about, you know, this is how we can change your business. And they're like, that's fine, let's do it. With the people who are more in the trenches and they're saying, well, what am I going to do tomorrow? If I fix this problem, then I'm going to automate myself out of a job. And the answer is absolutely yes. You will automate yourself out of a job. But if we go back to the way we opened up this conversation about growth and new capabilities, it's really about how do we move the people up the curve? Because if your companies and your team, your clients are doing those manual transactions, it usually means that they are not doing something more strategic. Right. And so you can say, hey, we're going to, because and it's a constraint that they have. They don't have enough people. The profit margins aren't big enough to be able to inflate their ranks so that they can have people doing both tactical and strategic things. And so the conversations we have are about moving people up that curve so they can start taking on more strategic roles. A great example that usually comes up in manufacturing is the number of buyers that companies have. Yeah. Their entire job is focused on looking at an MRP message, going, I'm not sure I trust that, going out to the floor to double check the inventory, coming back in to the office or into their desk and saying, looking at what material is in in transit already, doing the math and saying, you're right, maybe I should or shouldn't actually execute this MRP message based off of the data that's there. Obviously, that is something that can be very easily automated with any good ERP and a good set of data behind it. So the conversations we have with them is what would you do if you had more time, right? And almost always it's like, well, I'd do supplier relationship management. I would focus on doing more scorecarding and developing or issuing strategic RFPs to get better deals, right? I'd renegotiate certain categories on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Right? Those actually have tangible benefits. So that's the conversation we usually have across the kind of two different layers. Management, it's easy. The lower level teams, the people in trenches, it's more of a, hey, this is actually a really big opportunity for you to upskill and take on a more meaningful role. And really try to reinforce the fact that their job is not on the line.
Yeah, so very interesting. So we are going to touch a little bit more on the management issue, I guess, since you are claiming that it's easy, right? So I always try to be the proxy for my executives. Okay, so let's say the CFO. I trust you, Matt, because, you know, we probably have a working relationship. You mentioned that, you know what, we are going to do client relationship and you are really good at that, you know, and I can count on you. Maybe we have a relationship for last 5 years, 10 years, you know, you have never failed on me. So I'm going to trust whatever Matt says. Okay. But then I am getting signals from all over the place. Okay. I am getting signals from five vendors that I have in the mix in the maybe architecture or the transformation initiative that I'm doing. I am getting signal from my team. I am getting signal from my executives. And I am getting super confused, okay? So again, I'm going to trust Matt that, okay, whatever Matt says is going to happen. You know, it's probably going to work because nobody knows whether it's going to work or not, right? So that's always a challenge. Now, you have the other executives. So you have a relationship with me, but then you have five other executives. And typically with these issues, when you talk about inventory, supply chain, they are very cross-functional. If it were very departmental, then you would probably not have issues. So now you have a relationship with me. Now my WMS guy, he or she is claiming that, you know what, you require data change. You can change whatever you want, but I'm not willing to change. Okay. You don't have a relationship with them. So how would you sort of build the consensus in this scenario?
Yeah. So I think there's, yes, need to make sure we clarify my role, right? So like when it comes to like design decisions, that's not me. Right? I'm good at helping scope and understand where the capabilities are and what's going to impact the business. And so, yeah. You know, saying that I'm going to come in and be the guru that is truly a business expert across all the different functional areas, and I'm going to tell you exactly how to do it, when to do it, and what the outcome is going to be is very, very difficult. Right? And so what we really try to do, because you're right, even if I have a great relationship with you, I don't have that relationship with the other executives. And me being an outsider that's been working with the client for a short period of time, people are always going to be skeptical. Like it's natural. Yeah. So the way that we work around that is that when I go in, I tap the line leaders, right? Like the functional leads. And I start putting them in positions where they have to take ownership, right? And they start, so I might help drive the discussion. I might help maybe lead the horse to water a little bit, right? But at the end of the day, what we ask of those functional leaders is to get up in front of a steering committee or the executive committee and talk through how they are going to change the business. And two things can happen. First one is absolutely, I'm looking for that opportunity. I want to be considered a thought leader within the company, and I'm going to help drive that strategic vision. Or the other portion of it is, well, no, I really like what I'm doing. I'm that WMS guy that says I'm not going to change.
Yeah.
And you got to look at, we kind of coach them a little bit. Do you really want to get up in front of your executive team and dig your heels in and say, no, my way, the old way is the only way? Like, you're probably not the right person for this role anymore, right? So the way that we drive that is actually through the functional leaders to make sure that they take ownership and accountability for delivering results. And so if you're looking at something around I'll stick with the WMS one, right? So what's the inventory or carrying costs, right? Yeah. Or right, let's reduce overall inventory, right? How if right now it's inflated, how are you going to reduce that? And then when it comes time for actual implementation, you put them in the role that they're able to make decisions on what the future process is going to be. And absolutely, their decisions are going to align to what they just told the steering committee they're going to do. Hey, our inventory is inflated. I think we can reduce it. And once you get side by side with an SI, you're going to make decisions to make sure that you deliver on that. And so it really goes back to that change management.
Yep.
If it was the IT person saying that we're going to reduce inventory, no one's going to listen. If it was an outsider saying we're going to reduce inventory, no one's going to listen. When it's the warehouse leaders saying we're going to reduce inventory and this is how we're going to do it, and I'm going to take responsibility at the end of the day if we don't realize that result, that outcome, then they're quick to step up.
So very interesting. So in our experience, I guess our biggest problem are always executives, to be completely honest, because they just don't see it. They just don't see it. So for example, let's say the scenario that I had mentioned, let's say if CFO is able to see it because the CFO has, let's say, 4 or 5 different implementation, they have seen all of the issues, so they can relate with it, right? Now, VP of Ops, maybe they come from very WMS-centric background. Maybe they have seen some sort of implementation in the enterprise. The way it was implemented was very different from the company that you are implementing, and they are just not convinced with the solution that you are proposing. So the issue is going to be in building the consensus among executives. And if they don't agree with the solution, then obviously you need to take some sort of shortcuts, I guess. So the problem always is going to be among executives, because obviously, number one, they are at the position of authority. In fact, I mean, our biggest challenge always is the founders and CEOs, because they are so passionate. They have been only in one business. They have seen things only from one lens. They have never seen anything else. So changing them is a rocket science.
Yeah. Okay. So I see where you're coming from on this one. So there, I think there's a couple of conversations to be had. The first is showing them the level of change as well. So I've got a client right now. They've got an investor, and the investor is coming from a place where he got up in front of the group and said that he had SAP implementation experience, and that he at one point in time he was the FICO lead. A little bit more prodding, it was R3.
Yeah.
And so there's a conversation we had around, all right, let's talk about the level of change, the amount of change that's happened between R3. Not only has the technology changed, but the implementations have changed, right? And we're going from waterfall to more of an agile and iterative approach. We're going from a true customize everything approach to more of a best practices and standards approach. So there's a lot of you're right. You do need to have the conversation with the executive to say, you know, based off of your experience this one time at this one place several decades ago, that may not necessarily be applicable anymore. So there is that piece. When it comes to founders, you kind of alluded to it, but what we see a lot of is people coming in saying we're special. We do it this certain way because we're special.
Yep.
I would say that. So I've been doing these projects now for about 14 years. And out of all of my clients, I've only ever seen one client that actually truly had something special going on in the back office, right? Absolutely, the products are special, the R&D teams are special. You know, that is your secret sauce. The way that you pay an invoice, the way that you schedule logistics is not special, right? And so it's really talking about you're not special, and if you want to keep implementing new technology and taking advantage of kind of that, some of those hype cycles and some of the things that are out there, then you need to make sure that your underlying transactions are clean or you know, almost vanilla in nature. It's kind of going back to that, the model I shared earlier, right? Like data on the bottom and then your transactions, your processes, and then you get to your bigger capabilities. They all build on top of each other. So even if a founder says, I've got fantastic data, but you've gone through and you've completely destroyed your processes because you're special, right? And we do things differently, then again, that problem begins to percolate up. You can no longer do the reporting the way you want to. You can no longer take advantage of the new technologies, whether it be supplier networks, AI, and whatnot. So it's really having that conversation about how to future-proof your business, how to make sure that you're moving forward by having that clean core that you can then upgrade, and that you can innovate on the outside edges of your business, on the capabilities, the AI portion, but not, you don't innovate with your core transactions.
Okay, very interesting. So 14 years, long time in this career, I guess, in the change management space. Okay, give me some of your toughest change management challenges that you have seen in 14 years, where you really struggled.
I think it is some of those areas where it's that people have dug in so deeply. And you're right. Now that I think about it, it tends to be the executives saying I'm special. And sometimes it just takes a lot of handholding to bring them along. And you need to walk them through the process, and you need to find your advocates, and the message needs to come internally. Because again, everyone's going to be skeptical of the outsider. Doesn't matter how much experience I have and the things that I'm proposing. The message has to come from the inside. So, and that might be, we've had C-suite that while they're going through the motions of a selection process, but they already have a solution in mind. I want this, but they're just going through the motions. They have to prove to the rest of the C-suite. They have to prove to their teams that they are going to go evaluate other solutions out there. And at the end of the day, they end up selecting the one they want. And you're like, well, those almost always fail, but also it's just putting in the metrics to kind of capture some of those leading indicators of how quickly things are starting to go awry. So, when you start looking at someone, a C-suite that's already selected a solution, we start looking at things like, we do discovery sessions and workshops and the demonstrations, right? And all those scores are starting to come back. And so you can quickly get leading indicators on obviously at a surface level, it feels like, hey, which one do we want? But also it turns into a leading indicator to say, how much are people going to be engaged going forward? Right. So if any given solution is obviously not getting voted for, doesn't matter how committed people are to their job and how loyal they are, when they start seeing that their recommendations, their thoughts, their opinions are not being taken seriously, then they'll start to disengage, especially now with the kind of the market, the work from home and remote situation. It's so easy for people to find jobs, right? So people will disengage very quickly. So we'll use that as a leading indicator.
Yeah, very interesting. So I think we are close to our time now. Do you have any last minute closing advice for our listeners?
I think the biggest advice is get the teams involved early on. There's so much to change management. I think the old approach is, well, I'm just going to host some training. but there's so much more around understanding the magnitude of change, how it's going to impact people's mindset, their processes, the way they do their work, the way they perceive their work, their motivations, their incentives. And you need to get them those issues addressed early on. If it comes after the fact and it's reactive, it shows.
It definitely shows. And my personal takeaway from this conversation is going to be, again, change management has a lot of layers. So really dig into that, really deeply understand, open up your mindset, because that's what is going to be the biggest barrier for your change. On that note, Matt, I really want to thank you for your time. This has been a powerful episode.
Absolutely. Really appreciate the time. Looking forward to talking more.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks.
I cannot thank our guests enough for coming on the show, for sharing their knowledge and journey. I always pick up learnings from our guests, and hopefully you learned something new today. If you'd like to learn more about Matt, head over to Bearing Point USA at www.bearingpoint.com/EM-US/. It's www.bearingpoint.com/ EN-US. Bearing Points, Matt Ellis, senior manager in the firm's CIO advisory practice, helps mid-market companies on all things related to manufacturing, supply chain, increasing the value of the product and customer user experience. Links and more information will also be available in the show notes. Also, don't forget to subscribe and spread the word among folks with similar backgrounds. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please review and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform or DM me on any social channels. I'll try my best to respond personally and make sure you get help. Thank you, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of the WBS Podcast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the WBS Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform so you never miss an episode. For more information on growth strategies for SMBs using ERP and digital transformation, check out our community at wbs.rocks. We'll see you next time.